Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the 355th episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by patron Andrew Bourne, who joined at the $15 level. I don't know if he thinks he's going to get a hat at that level, because it's the $20 level is the hat level, but I feel like the only reason you would join at 15 is because you think you might get a hat. So Andrew, let us know what you're thinking. Anyhow, I'm Warren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we've got John Kasdan on the show. He is the showrunner behind the new Disney Plus show Willow, which is a sequel, not a reboot, a sequel to the classic Lucasfilm of the same title. It's getting some of the old cast back together. It's inheriting all this awesome mythology and a fan base and taking it into a new era. The show is super fun. I am legitimately a fan. I really enjoyed it. And boy, what a treat to talk to John Kasdan. I read in other interviews and we talked about it a little bit on the show. He was a little boy when that film was being made and got to be on set, like met Warwick Davis.
Yeah, well, his dad wrote Raiders of the Lost Ark and Empire Strikes Back right around the same time he was born. So he might have gotten to go on some cool sets, just like from his acting credits. He was in The Big Chill. He's in The Accidental Tourist. He's in Wyatt Earp. Was in Freaks and Geeks, and that was like where he really got like his break as a writer. He wrote on that show too. And we kind of dive into all that stuff. And I feel like he's just super forthright and open. And, you know, we talk about like one of my favorite things, which is like, how do you create scope? How do you make a shot feel big? How do you make a scene feel big? And especially, you know, they shot a lot of stuff during COVID. So they had, you know, real limited number of extras and things. And they were making this epic, epic show, you know, it's a Willow. It's like a Lucasfilm show. So
we talk about this on the show. You know, there's lots of Disney Plus shows that are really cool and are shot on the volume, and you know, everyone's on a soundstage and they go home and, you know, sleep in their own beds. This was in the mud. This was on location. This was just like the way they used to do it back in the day, shooting on location in the wilds. And we talk about that as well, and how there are pros and cons to that. There's a tactility to it. I think there's something real about it that the old film had, and I think the new show really wants to carry forward. And also that's less convenient than, you know, driving over to Lot in Burbank.
Before we talk to him, I wanted to tell you a quick story about what I've been working on lately. I know you wanted to just skip right into it, but
hit me. Oren, I've been dying to know, what have you been working on lately?
Dude, I'm working on this branded campaign with this guy, Jason Derulo, who's like a musician, and he's also really big on TikTok. He's like the 14th biggest person on TikTok. And the point is, he's like very present on the internet. He has hundreds of millions of followers across like all the social medias. And I was writing a script for him. And one of the scripts has just him kind of talking to the camera, like monologuing to the camera. And I wrote this thing that I thought was pretty funny and felt very much like Jason Derulo. But just for fun, I went to ChatGPT. And I said, could you please rewrite this in the style of Jason Derulo? And I pasted all my dialogue. It actually did a pretty good job. And I ended up taking probably 5 or 6 of the edits it made and putting them back into my script. And a couple of them weren't even really like more Jason Derulo-y, but they were just like cleaner ways to say something that I was saying, you know, in like 11 words, and that they said it in 6 words.
Sure. Yeah. It makes me think of like, have you ever used any of the writing apps like Grammarly or even, you know, suggested text in texting or an email, you know, through
Yeah. Gmail. But this is the fact that I could say in the style of Jason Derulo, because he exists on, if I said in the style of Oren Kaplan, it would not have any idea what to do.
I guess the reason I bring it up is because there's a lot of conversation about the nature of AI and how it's going to change creativity and take away all of our jobs and things like that. The point I'm trying to make is that in the same way that we have integrated searching rather than just knowing certain things,
yes,
right? Google's maybe taken away the jobs of encyclopedia salespeople, perhaps, but for the most part, it just becomes an additional tool in our tool belt. And in the same way that you have to have a human decide what's worth keeping and what's not with a search term, you had AI rewrite things, but you didn't take it wholesale, right? There still has to be taste is a part of it. And I think that's worth bringing up a little bit as well.
But what's interesting is that what I took from it were stylistic choices as opposed mm-hmm. to content choices.
In the same way, Grammarly, I think, gives you some stylistic choices, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was telling the person that I'm working on with this about it, and she said she directs also, and she said she's used it for treatments, that she'll make bullet points about what she wants to cover, and she'll mm-hmm. just put them in a ChatGPT, and it turns them into sentences. And then she's like a writer by trade. That's like her main background, and she'll just take it and edit it. And she's like, sure. I just like fly through treatments that way. So it's nuts. I'm more scared of like the Midjourney stuff. Like, we work so hard to make these beautiful frames, and then seeing someone, like half the people on my Instagram feed are like, check out these insane images I made. They're mm-hmm. so good. And I'm like, it's hard to be like to admire things anymore, you know, because they're so easy to make in certain ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's going to change the way that we think about things for sure and perceive
the
art.
Tools are pretty much earth shattering in my opinion.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I just wanted to tell you about that and tell our listeners.
That's a fun, very practical way of using emerging tools and technology. It's cool.
Well, before we talk to John Kasdan, I want to remind people that we have a Patreon, patreon.com/justshootitpod. It is a place where you can support us. You can hear more interviews like the one we have with John Kasdan, all the other amazing filmmakers that we have on the podcast. I think our goal here is to extract useful nuggets out of all these hundreds of different filmmakers. So hopefully you can use the stuff you like in your own career. I know Matt and I have done that for ourselves. So if you want to support us, $1, $2, $4, $15, or even at the $20 level, the level where you will get a personal Just Shoot It podcast hat that I will mail you, patreon.com/justshootitpod. We'd love to see you there. Speaking of Patreons, I just had a virtual coffee with Jamie Sadler, one of our oldest and truest and most committed patrons, who I believe listens to every episode. So I like to mention him a lot because it makes me happy to think that he's enjoying us talking about him. So thanks, Jamie Sadler. And thanks to everyone else that's a patron. And let's talk to John Kasdan.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Okay, John, thanks for coming into our podcast. A lot of our listeners are filmmakers. They want to know how to do what you do.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. You kind of constantly sort of feel yourself getting that question and like, well, how do you get into it? And what you find more and more is that everyone's path is so uniquely their own. And I'm a particularly strong example of that because I sort of grew up in the business and then started writing really young in television and have sort of been writing ever since. But certainly my way in and my way toward actual filmmaking has always been to just write and keep writing and hate writing, but do it anyway.
Yeah, I saw, according to IMDb, you're exactly 1 month older than me. I'm sure you get this a lot, but it seems like you were born and then your dad wrote Empire Strikes Back and Raiders.
He was working on those movies even before. And I think the fact that his career sort of began a little bit was one of the things that empowered my parents to have that second kid. They're like, we sure can maybe afford more diapers or whatever we need to do. And so I was sort of born right at a moment when he was able to make a living as a screenwriter for the first time in his life. And by the time I was old enough to understand what was happening, he was a director and a successful one at that.
Yeah. Matt has a 1 year old. How old is she? 14 months?
13 months. 13 months.
Yeah. And I have a 20-month old and a 6 year old. And it's like, it's a thing we talk about on the podcast all the time because we started this podcast 7 years ago before my daughter was born. And we're like, are kids going to ruin our careers? You know, and I think.
No, it's certainly a lot to handle. And my brother, who's got three of his own, is off in Atlanta shooting a movie right now. And he, you know, he feels it. It's hard to balance shooting. And I admire anyone who does.
So you started writing, it was Freaks and Geeks. Is that kind of your first kind of big writing job?
Yeah, I was writing spec scripts sort of before that and had found an agent by sending around a bunch of specs and sharing them with everyone I could possibly convince to read them.
Like TV specs or like features?
Action movies, which was really where my heart was. I was sort of taking meetings around the world, around the town, but also going to NYU and studying film and Freaks and Geeks sort of happened right as I was finishing my first year at NYU and the opportunity to sort of write one episode came up and it allowed for me to sort of be present for the entire life of that show, which was really the education I was, I think, really after.
I think famously that was kind of the move of that show. They were like, oh, we'll hire you for one episode, but we get basically a staff around the whole time.
I was not experienced and quite young, but I had real life, very immediate high school experience, which is the kind of thing that Judd and Paul liked. They liked diversity among their writers and people who could bring really what they were hoping for, I think more than anything, was people who had funny stories about being a teenager. And they didn't know that much about structure and building out a long form drama like that. So I got to be sort of witness to their education in it and my own. And I met people who would become my closest friends as I grew up. And one of them was Mike White. And he sort of sent me off to Dawson's Creek where he'd come from when that show ended.
Do you do like the studying, like when you write, like do you go places? And
well, one thing we did with Willow is we did a sort of cursory scouting thing in Wales just to sort of get a sense of where we could go. And frankly, I wish I'd been able to do more because, you know, one of the challenges of a show like this is you never have enough time or enough money or any of the resources you sort of expect. And I tend to write quite big and ambitious stuff and then sort of spend most of the shoot being slightly disappointed that it can't be what I had hoped it would be.
Well, let me tell you, you are on the right show, my friend.
Yeah, welcome to our world, John.
A tip I would say for trying to get scale in these kind of fantasy adventure shows that where you are up against it is to lean into wherever you are, you know. And with Wales, we tried to shoot out the 3-hour radius of where we were to whatever extent we could, and I think we did a good job. We had a great location team and they really knew the area and the crew knew the area.
So 100% of the show is in Wales? Is that right?
That's not technically accurate because the episode you'll see tonight, which shoots sort of in a forest area that borders the Puzzlewood Forest, crosses over into the UK for moments. In fact, there was a hilarious drama where a sickly little mouse was found on the set. And one of the Teamsters took it to its van and unknowingly had traveled it across country lines and invoked a diplomatic disaster when the mouse died, and the Welsh were held responsible, and it was all we could do to
extradite the mouse.
Yeah. Sure, yeah.
Did you guys do any volume? I mean, it's an ILM show, right? Or a Lucasfilm show, right?
No, we didn't. We, you know, the thing about the volume is it's a wildly expensive thing to do. And you really have to plan for it. You have to use it enough to sort of validate its expense and the mm-hmm. amount of time and work that needs to go into figuring out exactly what you're going to do with it, you know? Mm-hmm. So what we did use, though, is we used a Translite for several episodes that we then enhanced digitally with sort of bringing the sky to life and mm-hmm. stars and all that.
So the Translite, so for our listeners that don't know, it's a giant basically backdrop that you can light from behind, and you can make it look like day or night based on how you light it, right? Light it from the front, it's day, and from the back, it's night.
It was a great tool actually for what we needed. You know, it's like a lot of these things, and the creature effects being sort of the perfect example, these old tools tend to be really great when wedded to mm-hmm. digital tech in some way. So like the puppet characters we created that had a digital element in them were our most successful sort of goes.
Yeah, I'm dying to ask you about how you approached having, you know, a film that, like, in my heart and mind is like kind of like a perfect example of that old school ILM, you know, matte paintings and stop motion. You know, I feel like it's an ideal effects film in many ways. And now you have all of these tools, right?
As we were toiling away in Wales, sort of in the pouring rain and mud, my dad was back home in his house in Los Angeles, making a documentary about ILM. Mm-hmm. And he did mm-hmm. the entire documentary literally without ever leaving his house, you know, and it's one of my favorite things he's done in quite some time. But I would, you know, we talk on the phone every once a week or something. I'd be like, how's it going? He'd be like, it's going great. I was in the pool and then I directed for a little while. And
yeah, it's incredible. How's the mud, son?
But one of the things that ILM documentary does beautifully is it sort of talks about that period, really mm-hmm. goes into that period in their evolution, you know, and what a transformative moment it was, because it sort of wed the stop motion genius of those guys, you know, who are doing that, and even the matte painting world and all of that, with the sort of burgeoning digital mm-hmm. thing that was happening with morphing and technology. And it was sort of at the last of the age of the sort of big effects movies done in the old style and the first of those done in the new, you know?
And so how it's so classic. And I think that the new show does a really great job of paying homage to that look and style and feel, right? And I'm curious, on a practical level, how do you, like, it's easy to say, like, make sure that it feels painterly, or like, I want it to feel tactile or whatever, but how do you literally get a team of people to make it look the way you want it to look?
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing that I really had to my advantage is that I had been very present on Force Awakens, and Kathy had sort of produced Force Awakens on a granular level. And then Michelle Rejwan, who was running Lucasfilm at the time we were shooting the show, had come from being JJ's assistant on Force Awakens, or rather producer on Force Awakens, had been his assistant prior. And so all three of us had come together on the set of that movie. And JJ had really set a precedent in a great way of leaning into practical effects in any opportunity he could, and then embracing the tools of digital effects to make that a more seamless, more elegant bit of work. And we tried to sort of just embrace that approach to whatever extent we could. And one of the great assets of it was that Neil Scanlan, who'd done all the creature work on the Star Wars movies, I sort of ran into this project with the just assumption that we were going to be taking Neil with us. And from day one, sort of said, well, Neil's on the show, you know, he'll be with us. And there was never a moment when he was even asked whether or not he wanted to do it. It was just kind of assumed he'd do it.
I should try that.
It was sort of an interesting thing where he was sort of, they were on Andor at the same time and sort of being stretched very thin, but liked the idea of working in a fantasy world and doing these kind of creature work that we were talking about doing. And then the other element of it that was critical, I think, to what you're talking about is that it was really important that we didn't shoot on the volume and that we gave it a location look. Because so much of what resonated for me about the movie was this tactile, muddy, wet world that Warwick was sort of sloshing his way through felt so real to me that we really wanted to achieve that. And, you know, if I had it to do over again, I don't know if I would have done it with quite as much gusto, because it's hell out there when you're, you know, when you've got eight actors and you're in the rain and it's really cold and none of them want to be there. But it certainly pays off in the show itself, which has the feel of a 80s fantasy.
For sure. Know? As a kid, like, that's what I loved about Willow is it's so easy to imagine yourself just running through the woods and doing all these crazy things they're doing.
Yeah, it's a big part of the power of it. And then when you add in things like, you know, the dogs, even in their sort of ridiculous costumes, they had the movement and the ferocity of real dogs.
Sure, yeah, sure. Yeah. Just
gave the whole thing a kind of experiential reality for children that was scary and fresh and a big deal.
Yeah. I'm curious, just another question about the look. Like, obviously this is a TV show, it's episodic, it's made for TV. Was there ever a question in anyone's mind about shooting anamorphic versus 16:9?
No, you know, I mean, a lot of it has to do with the streamer and how best to sort of use the shape of the image there and how they kind of collate their data and process everything internationally. But what we knew we sort of always wanted was as cinematic a look as we could get, you know, and to kind of keep it feeling like, I think one of the things Disney is doing well is they're sort of trying to create a filmic experience at home, particularly with these Lucasfilm branded, even more I'd say than with the Marvel stuff. It's like they're really trying to preserve something that feels cinematic and wide and a big big frame, you know.
Right. I like what you were saying earlier about scale. Like, are, like, do you have any kind of go-to tricks, whether it's in the writing, in the producing, or in the directing?
You know, we're trying to lean into sort of our bigger vistas and creating a show that feels like the scale of the world that these characters are inhabiting is much bigger than them. And it was always a battle I was sort of fighting, which is that it never feels small. And, you know, it can be tricky because one of the challenges of shooting Willow was that we shot it in the sort of depths of COVID. And the way in which that most literally affects you, other than the years of your life it takes off with worrying about who's going to get sick, is that you just can't have as many extras on the set as you would like to, you know? So what we'd often have are spaces that were too big and not enough people to fill them, you know? And that was a constant source of frustration and sort of nagging difficulty. Was like, you want hundreds of extras, you're going to get 50.
Right. And I know this is hyper specific, but what are like some tricks? What are some solutions to kind of overcome that?
Well, one thing that, you know, we did a couple of times is we tried to do some crowd replacement, you know, which is an expensive and tricky process in and of itself, because you have to sort of film the individual elements, which is a time crush, you know. So you're off, you've got some unit of your crew off somewhere shooting extras and plates of extras. And then, you know, you only sort of have as many as you have, which can be a little tricky.
Like, you mean you have like 20 different versions of extras and you're tripling them, or
you only double them so many times, or And really what you'd love to do is you'd love to be able to do everybody and then be able to, you know, intersperse them as much as possible, because it's tricky. But then there's the actual cost of laying them into the shots and sort of rotoing everything together. So it's not a cheap solution to the problem. And like, you know, the cheaper and certainly more effective method was that you would have people cross the camera, walk around behind the camera, and then cross again, you know, and you would have them cross closer and further away and keep it as busy as you could.
Yeah.
But what you never got and is really hard to achieve is huge crowds that sort of were specific to, you know, the great sort of epic stories of our lifetime and things like even those first three Lord of the Rings movies. It's like you get the sense of thousands of extras dressed as orcs, you know, hundreds at least out there sort of fighting. And that was always really, really difficult to achieve. But what isn't as difficult to achieve in Wales are these expansive landscapes, because an hour and a half out from where we were shooting at Dragon Studios, you get these vast fields and these sort of distant mountains and a sense of a real fantasy world, you know? And we were really shooting to that as much as possible, going out on location whenever we could, sort of trying to do as little on stage as we had to, also just practically because we were constantly turning over our stages to turn them into some other set. You know, one of the big challenges of a show like Willow is that as a quest that's constantly moving forward, very few of the sets are amortizable over the season. You know, we really had almost nowhere.
There's no central perk in Willow. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Surely if we do a season two, that'll be the very first set we have is the central perk you can keep. Sure.
Right. The pub.
You know, it speaks to what we're sort of saying about wanting to do something that felt really cinematic. Was just like you wanted to give people this kind of sense of a long journey that they're going on with these characters over the course of the season, the way Willow really successfully does that, even though they seem their path is a bit circuitous. They do seem to be traveling the whole movie, you know, and sort of getting further from home, so that by the end, when he's sort of facing Bab-Morda in the castle, you feel like he's a long way from where he started, you know? And I thought that feeling was a big part of what Willow meant to me, you know? And I certainly wanted this to feel like by the end of this season, they've gone way farther, you know, and you've earned that journey along the way. The one thing I knew I wasn't going to do this, there wasn't going to be a scene at the end where suddenly you cut to him getting back home and they just all hug. And I wanted the distances to feel real and like they were going to take a long time. And, you know, I like to imagine right now somewhere Willow is out there trying to find his way.
So, John, you obviously directed too. You've directed a couple features back in the day. I was curious why on Willow, the show you're showrunning, obviously a showrunner encompasses probably a lot of things the director does.
I love directing. It's the most fun part of the job, certainly. But, you know, they all sort of, a lot of people had said to me that early on that, like, you know, and I was very gung-ho about doing it. And they said, you know, you should do it for a year because you'll be shocked at how every second of your life is occupied in running the show. And they said, you know, Favreau doesn't really do it. And these shows tend to be sort of most effective when the showrunner is fully showrunning. And I was skeptical and certainly grouchy about it. And by the time I was halfway through the season, there was very little way I could have done more than what I was doing on the thing. And even so, it's frustrating because there are things that you've like, well, that's not how I would have done that. And I write in a very sort of specific sound and you constantly kind of want to be there for every second of it. But the challenge is, you know, you're almost always prepping and cutting as you're shooting.
Because you have a schedule, like a release schedule to hit.
You really do. And you've got your editors for a certain amount of time.
Visual effects, I'm assuming, is taking a long time.
Absolutely. I mean, started visual effects work probably a week or two after we started shooting, which was May of 21. And mm-hmm. they have been on until about 2 weeks ago.
Cranking.
So, yeah. You know, it's like every year you're in a review every week. You're sort of moving it forward at every moment. And what you find, frankly, is that sort of part of the necessary work of being a director, which is keeping the crew moving, keeping the next setup happening, is not always the most valuable use of your time. Yeah.
I can imagine you must have been in a moment where you're like in a review or something, kind of like in the sludge of it. And at least you can think to yourself, well, someone's shooting right now. And both are happening at the same time. And maybe there's a little comfort to that.
You have a remote monitor at every minute of everything. So, you know, when they're not shooting.
Is that crazy making, though? That would mess me up. I feel like it, like out of sight, out of mind a little bit.
I mean, to be honest, for the comedy, it's like, you know, jokes, particularly sarcasm heavy comedy, like I tend to write, they either sort of are getting the joke or they're not. And if you're not sort of on top of it, your batting average, depending on who and what the circumstance, but there, it's not consistent enough to not sort of feel like you need to be, to have an eye across it if you want to get a certain thing, which I always sort of.
Do you guys do like rehearsals and things and like tone? I'm assuming tone meetings, obviously.
I mean, I was on set as much as humanly possible. And then when we were on, we had our studio in Wales that was sort of our home base. Mm-hmm. And I was able to sort of move pretty smoothly from the production designer's office to the editing room to the set. And it was, the days were full in that respect. But certainly, what I imagine would be great is that when everything is done and when your show is locked, the way Mike White does it, which is to direct all of it and be able to cross board the entire series, feels like the most efficient way to get what you're really after.
Yeah. Well, it helps when it's all, yeah, in one location.
It does. That really, and it's a beautiful place where it's always warm and gorgeous.
So a show like Willow, an action thriller, sarcastic comedy, fantasy, epic cinematic series, do you guys storyboard all of it?
Some of it is a lot. We do. We have a great, you know, we use Third Floor, who does a lot of the previs all around town. And they're sort of the best in the world at this. And they're sort of all over the world. And we have sort of a dedicated editor and a dedicated team doing our bigger sequences across the season, sort of building out the big action beats and really, really trying to invest in doing well what we want to do well. And then the other stuff, we hope to do boards for everything we can, and sort of, because you find that in that kind of a time crunch, unless you've really planned it out before, you're not going to get the epic shot that makes it. Mm-hmm. You're going to be struggling enough to get the coverage and to get what you need to finish the scene, that unless there's a very sort of a strong intent to get something visual and dynamic and exciting, then it's the first thing you won't get.
100%. Right. Can you talk to us a little bit about how one approaches previs? Like what's step one on a process like that?
We had a great storyboard artist who I would sort of walk through a sequence with our storyboard artist. She would do
like you would just talk to her about it. You're not doing sketches or anything.
And, you know, I speak almost exclusively in references to other movies. Mm-hmm. So I'd show her a shot. I'd show her an image from something. We'd talk about the kind of visual energy we wanted to have.
When you're speaking, referencing other movies, do you spend time finding references in other movies or just stuff that you remember from
hold on, this shot from Alien, and you pull it up?
Yeah. And it's usually stuff that, like, you know, when you've had to sort of suffer through writing one of these sequences, you've drawn these references in your head long ago. So they're pretty easily accessible to what you're trying to do, you know?
So you're not creating it from the whole cloth in the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're using them in every aspect of the pre-production, in terms of, like, you know, the sort of concepting the various weapons and vehicles and sort of the costumes of a sequence, into the storyboarding of the sequence, into what inevitably becomes the sort of previz stage. And then, of course, the biggest challenge, because these previz guys are great and the shots are always exciting, is having the time and the resources to get it. When you're also trying to get scenes that are heavy in dialogue and performances and all that stuff.
Do you have like a show Bible or like some visual language that you, I know you have four different directors on this show.
Yeah. And we do. And you sort of build out a huge book of sort of concept art and reference art and all this stuff.
Is there ever rules? Like, this is how we shoot overs. We never do two shots. We always go as wide as we can to show the environment, or
we try to instill certain things, which are like in television, you know, the need for close-ups is paramount, you know, in terms of entering the characters and getting tighter. And, you know, directors who go into a show like Willow or a show like Star Wars with a very filmic intention, you know, you show up on day one, you think, I'm going to make a movie. I'm a television director and I'm going to make a movie. And you sort of find yourself constantly saying like, yeah, okay, you are making a movie, but you also need to get like close-ups like a TV show, because this is how this stuff works a little bit. And, you know, more than not, where our time would be wasted is with attempts to do sort of mid-sized things, you know, masters that are cool and move in a fun way that ate up so much of the day in choreography and in planning that we were strapped when it came time to get into the performance and where the scenes would really live, you know? And if I had advice for directors coming into television, it's like, you know, it's often worth starting with the coverage and letting the performances get there, you know, figure out what the performances are, figure out, make sure you've got it. And then you have a lot more freedom and a lot more fun to play around.
Yeah. I love it's that.
Funny. In features, we always hear the opposite, right? You kind of work out the performance in the wide shot and then go in for the close-up.
I've found working with actors who have very different methodology to how they work. Some of whom it's a lot up front and there's a lot of nervous energy, and others who sort of ease into figuring it out and who are very consistent and can do it again and again. You know, I find that if I can sort of put everyone to ease, that the moments of the scene are there, then there's a lot more joy in the sort of exploratory filmmaking around it. And when you're able to marry that with a real plan, if you can get in and get the coverage and then say, okay, I have a shot that I've been wanting to do all day, and here's how it's going to work. You guys are going to do the same thing, but the camera's going to do this. Then you really have a chance, at least, at something that's sort of exciting and kinetic.
Are you laying the blocking in that you kind of have in the back of your head for that fun shot into that coverage to begin with? Or how, because that was always the thing that makes me.
You constantly finding your locations are not exactly what you'd hope they'd be. And one of the things I found incredibly useful is like, you know, anytime there's an opportunity to rehearse in the location or to stunt viz in the location, we had a great stunt team who would go out and shoot on an iPhone and bring it back, and you'd look at it and you'd know what you were really after and what you were a little less focused or urgently needed to get, you know, and that ended up being incredibly helpful. But the more prep the directors did, the better off they were, you know, and when they did less, it often cost us. One of the ways in which we were able to afford to make the show was that, you know, you're constantly looking for savings in various ways. And one was that we used entirely UK-based directors.
Oh, interesting.
A huge saving, but also a huge limitation on who you can pull from. Particularly when you want to hire lots of different kinds of directors and try different things. But we found four people that were passionate about the show and loved the show. And the first of them was Stephen Wolfenden, who had come from being a second unit director for David Yates on the Harry Potter movies and just had a kind of grounded day-to-day experience on getting it done that was invaluable and stayed with the show throughout and sort of was our cleanup man on everything we needed. And then we had some younger people like Debs Patterson and Jamie Childs, who had both sort of are at the beginnings of their career and both super talented. And then this director, Philippa Lothorp, who had worked on The Crown and brought a gravitas and a touch with actors that was really nice and that I think they appreciated.
When you meet these directors or interview them, what are you looking for from a conversation with them?
I'm assuming you've already seen their credits. Someone who can get along with your sort of sense of humor and your internal references and knows what you're talking about, you know, a little bit. And it's, you'd be shocked at how difficult that can be to find, which is just someone who sort of, you can reference a shot in a movie from 20 years ago and they'll know, oh yeah, that, you know, you mean that right. Tracking shot from, yeah, that tracking shot from Lord of the Rings when they're on the road and, you know, and just like sort of that kind of familiarity is a real gift because it's all about finding people you can be as specific as possible with what you want.
I mean, obviously you mentioned Philippa and working on The Crown and her ability with actors. Do you, because it's a TV show and you're, you know, by episode 3 to 8, these actors probably know their characters pretty well.
They had me and that really changes the dynamic. I think on a lot of these, I think specifically in the UK, but although I couldn't tell you for sure, but the showrunner isn't as omnipresent.
Oh, interesting.
As we are here in the States. And the actors would sort of knew that they were coming to me if they wanted to talk about their character, where their character had been and where it was going. And and again, for the comedy. And it meant that the division of labors was slightly skewed in that way.
Well, awesome. Yeah, super exciting show.
This is great kind of questions that can only be asked by other directors.
Years and years ago now, we had a director on. When he realized that we weren't going to ask him what it's like to work with The Rock, he hung out for 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like, we used to do it in person and it's late at night. We'd have a beer.
I mean, I saw an interview with Fincher once where he was like, you know, the hardest thing is you never have enough time. And the whole legend of Fincher is he didn't care how much time. It's like, yeah. I think that even that guy who was so empowered to do exactly what he wanted was feeling the same thing of just being up against it every minute is really the unifying theme in all this work. It's like,
it's the unifying theme of all of life is we just need more time.
Just need a little more time.